Welcome to the show, everybody. I hope you enjoy today's episode with my old friend Pete Holmes. Next week, Grant Lindahl will be on the show. I am going to be on the road like crazy, so we may skip a week after that. I may be doing some stuff on Patreon, patreon.com, mind under pod. I've been doing a bunch of psychedelic meet and greets, getting ready for the Better Trip show, and I have this warm-up tour. Guys, I just started stringing these shows together very last minute because I was still waiting on things to come through with the camp out and things like that, and now that I'm 100% focused on making Vegas stuff happen, I have lined up a whole bunch of shows, and I'm thrilled to say that even though I haven't toured in 3 years, that these shows are selling out fast, most of them anyway. Some we're gonna have to add some extra dates, but it starts today. If you're watching this on a Too Easy Tuesday, starts today in DC. We got a real late start on advertising that one, but it's filling in. And then Thursday, March 2nd, it is Charleston, which is moments away from selling out, probably sold out by the time that you're hearing this. I tried to add another show, but they just don't have any other days available, and things are real tight right now, timing wise. Friday, March 3rd, I'm in Greensboro. That's a real fun club. I imagine that will sell out as well. Small venue. March 4th, Saturday afternoon show, 420 show, bruh, in Raleigh at Good Nights, brand new location, Good Nights Comedy Club. I think that's selling really well. It's a pretty big place. Don't know if it's going to sell out or not, but it'll be a real fun show. Asheville just had to add a date. So Tuesday, March 7th, probably by the time you're hearing this is selling out, there might be some possibility of moving people that are interested in moving from it to the Monday before. So super last minute, we added a Monday with hardly any notice. So Monday, March 6th, Asheville, really cool venue, different world. It's actually, it used to be a different venue that I did there, and I always loved the place, so I'm excited to see how it's changed under new ownership. And March 8th at the Laughing Skull in Atlanta. One's like not selling for some odd weird reason. I'm having trouble in Atlanta at the moment, but sometimes a lot of times my shows don't really start selling until like a week away or so, but still tickets in Atlanta. Then Bentonville, Arkansas, March 10th, Friday, two shows at a little brewery. I just put these shows online yesterday to give you an idea of how fast this stuff is moving. Working on that Sunday, March 12th in Oklahoma City. Don't know if that's going to happen or not. It does look like I'm adding the Saturday, March 11th to Tulsa. I'm going to be a very busy boy, flying by the seat of my pants. I don't know how many times I need to say that in how many different ways. But then I'm making my way to LA. So then I'm working on Santa Fe, Albuquerque, venue right now. I haven't performed in those places much, but I have some leads. Same with Flagstaff, Arizona. They're just anything in that mountain time zone is off the beaten path for comedians. And so, I don't have, the same leads in those cities that I might have in like lots of other places that I went through a lot more frequently, but working on those. Have a show in Malibu, March 22nd, working on some other spots. I'm trying to get spots like outside of LA, like, San Diego and maybe Riverside and a couple other, some stuff like an hour, 2 hours, outside of LA. Like I just wrote a venue in Joshua Tree that I thought would be perfect for it. And so make sure and join the mailing list at shanemoss.com if you haven't, because this is how fast I'm adding shows. After that, I am working on, putting together like probably a 2-ish week tour around New England is the current plan with my friend Mike Kaplan. Gonna open the shows for me. It's not 1,000% that that's going to happen, and I haven't even reached out to any of the venues yet, putting together a list in the routing and getting started in on that. But I started comedy in Boston. That should be a pretty easy one to string together. And then swinging through New York to do some promo and stuff. I'll be getting on podcasts in LA. When I said I might have a week off of Mind Under Matter coming up after the Grant episode, it's because I'm kind of holding off because I'm going to be in LA for a couple of weeks and I want to shoot some in person, and Ramin's there, hoping to meet up with him and possibly record and stuff too. And so I just thought I had some ideas for some guests, and like five of the people that I reached out to, like Rory Scovel being one of them, and a few other people, they're all in LA, and I kind of like the idea of maybe just doing them in person. Might be a lot cooler. Doing that, and and then the Area 15 shows start April 23rd, the Vegas residency, and getting real excited about that, putting together all sorts of really fun and interesting stuff. And then that's what it is. The weekend of May 14th, we've confirmed that a few people from a few mummies already have already bought some tickets and are going. You can jump on Discord. Let me know if you need a Discord link and coordinate from there. Don't totally know what we're going to do yet, other than we'll like go and walk around as a group on the strip. Maybe I'll get a private room to hang out in at Area 15 at one point, and you know, see Meow Wolf and Omega Martin and stuff there. Putting together, talking with some people that live in Vegas, like for example, it could be there's a planetarium there that is potentially collaborating with me on an aspect of my show. And I can probably have a private showing in a planetarium there for us while we're there. There's just a lot of fun stuff like that, that there's a world of possibilities in Vegas. So if you're a listener of the show, you want to meet up with other listeners of the show, that's that May 14th weekend. You can come anytime, hit me up when you're in Vegas. There's going to be meet and greets after the show, and probably get to say hi and everything else. But that May 14th weekend is the one where I'm going to set aside, several days. So anyone that comes in, I'll be around there from like that, pretty much that whole week. I'll probably get in like Wednesday night before and stay until the Tuesday after or something like that. So even if people are on different schedules and stuff like that, I might be able to hang out and put small gatherings and get togethers together. Again, no like extra charge for that. Just anyone that feels like coming out and flying out and getting a room and that sort of thing. I would look up Palace Station first. It's walking distance to Area 15, and they have pretty reasonable rates. You'll see that it varies dramatically based on the weekend and everything else, but I have gotten rooms there for under $100. I've also gotten rooms there for, I looked, I was going to get some rooms there for a coming St. Patrick's Day weekend, and they were like $200 or something like that. And so, you know, St. Patrick's Day weekend, different sort of situation, but I've gotten them around like 100. I think someone just posted on Discord that they got a room for 111, and so can be pretty reasonable. Vegas flights can be pretty reasonable as well. Vegas may not be a thing that you're into. Totally understand. Just like campouts aren't a thing that everyone's into as well. Hoping to have a whole bunch of different offerings and ways that the community can get together and grow in the future. And this is just one of them. So thanks for listening to my whole long intro, and enjoy Pete Holmes. Remember to join my mailing list. Shane Moss, MAUSS.com. And I will be sending out all sorts of updates on upcoming shows. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Mind Under Matter podcast. Heat Holmes is joining us today.
Hello.
Do you listen to podcasts yourself?
I do listen to podcasts.
Yeah,
I do. Yeah.
I don't listen to many. Yeah, they're fun. I like being on them. I like hosting them. Don't listen to that many. When do you listen to podcasts?
Well, I moved outside of Los Angeles, so I now have a 90 minute commute into town.
You are no longer in the place that I'm familiar with. That's right. You moved? You moved from that house? Oh wow. You've been there for years.
I'm
not troubled. I'm just like, I feel like I don't know you anymore. I don't.
I mean, we didn't make a big stink of it because a big part of the play was to, like, I remember my manager was like, yeah, we got this like show offer for you at the store, but we told them you don't live in LA anymore. Like, stop bothering us. And I was like, no, don't do that. Like,
why would you?
Yeah, it's like something you'd see. Remember on the show Louie, he had like a really sort of inept.
I loved that agent character.
It's literally like a bumbling move, like the exact opposite of what I would want, which is like, look, I'm moving outside of the city, but you don't want the people in that city to think you're not available for things.
Yeah.
Because I will drive in and just do a spot, you know.
90 minutes. If you're in LA, it's 90 minutes to get to a grocery store anyway.
It's like true. It's true. And when I go to the, you know, where you make up the time is driving my daughter to school is now 10 minutes. Driving to the grocery store is 5 minutes. So like all of the time, it's about the same amount of time in the car, but I do it in these lump sums. So that's when I do most of my reading, which is a father of a 4-year-old. It's really hard to read and podcasts and learn. Yeah. So the car has become this sort of very, let's not say sacred, but precious. It's a very precious time for me. And there have been times when like I'll drive home, but I'm listening to something that I love so much that I'm like, maybe I'll just circle the block, you know, just to finish it.
Yeah. I love a good drive. I'm just starting to do some work again, gearing up for Vegas show and stuff. And so I'm finally starting to get some long drives in, and it's when my brain is at its best.
Steven Spielberg used to drive around with a tape recorder in his car, and that's where he had all his best ideas. And somebody explained that to me, this is right up your alley, that there's something scientific going on to occupying your motor function.
If you give
the part of your brain that were it not operating your car might be giving you things to worry about or like a grocery list, but you give it this menial task. It literally is not like a meditation. It is a meditation. Meditation is occupying that overactive part of your brain with a mantra or beads or breathing. You're driving. It's the same as rock climbing or different athletics. You know, you're occupying the part of your brain that otherwise might be distracting you. And then you get this added bonus of being able to have clean, clear thoughts. So it's a very regular occurrence that I'm texting myself. That's how I take notes safely in the car. It's because I can just hold down the button on the steering wheel and say, text Pete Holmes. And then I say the most absurd things to my phone.
So can I ask you, recording stuff is one thing. I find revisiting the things that I have recorded, that's something that I have a hard time getting around to doing. You're a very disciplined person, I feel like. No?
No. That's why, see, stand-up comedy to me is the ultimate way to force yourself to be creative and to be proactive. Yeah. Because if you don't write down what you texted yourself in the car or transfer it, I have like a file that's all of it's my hour of stand-up in order, and I'll just go and I'll add that line to the document, okay?
Yeah.
And the reason I'm disciplined enough to do that is because if I don't, it results in physical pain.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't understand writing books. I've written a book, but like, it's not the same. Stand-up is is, you know, a high wire act over flames and spikes. So, and you're just the perfect person to talk about this. Like that motivating factor, it's like human beings will do more to avoid pain than they will to pursue pleasure is something I've heard.
Yeah.
So when I'm actually writing down a note to myself, I'm doing the laziest thing possible. I'm like, this will make me feel less pain when I do stand-up comedy, because there's nothing worse than eating shit. And when I'm writing a movie script or a TV script or something, I'm trying to synthesize a version of that fear, not fear, but adrenaline. It's better to say like something that adrenalizes me, because I'm not scared, but I'm trying to motivate it. Like this will lead to pleasure and less pain.
How often are you eating shit these days? Do you ever... I haven't done much stand-up. I've been focused on a bunch of other projects and putting together festivals and other weird shit. But
and the bounties you're collecting?
And the bounties that I'm collecting. is that what I look like to you? That's very good, actually.
You look like if there was a bounty on me and you showed up, I'd be so happy, because you're not going to duct tape me. You're going to let me ride up front in your truck with you. You're going to give me a sandwich. You're going to be like, oh, I know it's a rough deal, but somebody paid me a lot of money on you down. You've been a bad boy. Have you ever done DMT? And like, we'd liberate our minds and then you'd drop me off the local authorities.
That's me as a bounty.
Yeah. Oh, hey. But you'd be kind. There's actually a compliment baked in here. You look like a gentle, understanding bounty hunter. I'd be so thrilled.
I'm just trying to make a living.
Yeah, I'm good at it. It's just a game.
I'm good at finding people. I don't know what it is.
It's my skill. And that is not what you sound like. That is just an absurd impression.
I absolutely love it.
But to answer your question, I still eat shit. I don't eat shit.
Do you ever eat shit on purpose?
I do weird things on stage as a result of being too comfortable.
Yeah.
If I tour a little too much,
I
just get absurd. I start calling myself old Holmesy and like daddy. I'll be like, daddy's driving the car to Disneyland. Like it's like almost like you're mainlining authority over people. I don't feel like I have authority over them, but it's your job as a performer to shepherd the audience to the experience of laughter. And if you do that too much, again, you're the perfect person to talk about this. It just does something to your brain. It's why tyrants go insane. Yeah. It's not healthy to always be in the spotlight position. This is what happens with so many celebrities and so many. So when I have a bad set, it's usually because I'm performing too much and I'm normalizing something that should be special. I like to go on the road once a month, so it's special. You go out and it's still novel. It's still exciting. There's still a little bit of stakes. You're not just like this robot that's like, I still have a set list on stage. I need to look at it. I can't, it's not like baked in so tight that I'm like, and then you do this and then you do this and then you do this. I'm still glancing at my notes and stuff because I want to do it a little bit raw. So when I do badly, I just did a show. I was in Vancouver for the Comedy Fest and I was there a night early. So I jumped up on Joe DeRosa's wonderful show, which is great. If you get a chance to see it, it's really funny. And he was like, Holmes, you want to do 10? And I just went up and I had a good set. But to me, I was like, oh shit, I'm getting spoiled. Because another weird thing that can happen is if you only perform for audiences that more or less want to see you, like your audience, you start grading the set. You know, your reference point is 1,000 people that came to see you. And now you're weighing that against 300 people that came to see Joe DeRosa, some of whom may know you, but most of them don't, you know, that's a stupid metric, but that's when I'll go like, oh, I didn't do that well. You know, I wasn't that good tonight.
That's interesting. I like a good bomb. Like I'll go if I have like, you know, a good chunk on something like very dark and then it just doesn't go my way, I'm like, I can dig into this a little bit. Like I can feel like I could do things to pull out and get the energy and get a bunch of, but I kind of just want this to be like a little dark right now. Like I'll make sure I'm still getting laughs and everything, but
something's happening.
Yeah. Something's happening. There's,
like you're doing, and everybody's feeling alive, you know, like it's going a little bit wonky.
Yeah, there's a feel. Exactly. It feels like it feels brave and like vulnerable, and it just feels like very real. And it feels because like sometimes getting laughs is just like the easy part, you know, it's like the safe, especially new stuff. No, but like. You can always just pull out that tried and true.
Yeah.
This is always going to get them. There's like always an out. So to like not give yourself an out.
I agree.
I don't know. There's something about it.
I think it's a response to social media and how everything's curated and perfect and sliced into 30-second chunks of the best part. And when you see a live show, this most special thing you can share with them often is a real moment. And I have a line that I use in moments like that. I'm like, see, don't feel bad. If this was on TV or on your social feed, you'd swipe away. You'd stop watching because it's weird. But here we're stuck in it.
Yeah.
Special about that. You and I grew up in the 80s. All of the weird was being stuck in a moment. Like there was no escape.
You think so? That's what you think about the 80s?
Yeah. You were stuck in just one reality. It wasn't bad. I'm just saying like what was in front of you is what was happening. Church? You just be at fucking church? You couldn't like secretly be detaching or watching a movie on your phone or whatever.
Yeah, that's fun. That's an interesting take.
You don't agree? Huh. You didn't feel stuck in reality in the 80s? There was nothing else going on but reality.
I felt like there was a contrived reality that I was stuck in that was confusing to me. And
I don't mean absolute reality. I just mean you went to the fucking, well, I'm thinking of East Coast places, but you went to the 99, the steakhouse to eat dinner, and that's all you were doing. And now you take it for granted, but you go to the bathroom and you might watch some of the best entertainment in the world while you're taking a pee.
That's true. I took Instagram. You just
smelled the 99. Like that's all you did.
In October, I did a sober October where it was like everything, every single possible vice. I'm like, I'm just quitting all of it as just a weird experiment. And one of the things was I took Instagram off my phone, and for days when I would use the toilet or whatever, I shocked myself by just how automatic it was to just scroll through and then have to go, wait, where? Where's Instagram? Why am I not looking at a video right now? And it is that's true. That is how we're living our life. So the '80s. Okay. All right. I'm feeling you. Anytime someone says the '80s, I just picture like the Reebok pumps and like the clothes and stuff. And then I just stop listening. I think I just start picturing Reebok pumps and
slap
and like, the slap bracelet and the spandex pants stuffed.
Yeah.
And maybe like Jabos or something like that. And I'm like, what do you mean we were in the moment? But I guess that was the moment.
That was the moment. Yeah.
That was the moment.
There were people in the 80s that were...
Well,
that's why I always think it's so funny when I listen to old talks from Terrence McKenna or Ram Dass or whatever. In Ram Dass's case, he's using like what I consider to be pretty deep dive terms from Hinduism. There's all these white people that understand what he's talking about. You know, if it's a video, you can tell that they're... What I mean is non... Hindu raised people that are like, oh yeah, the Brahman, you know? And I'm like, why do they know what this is? And when Terrence McKenna would be talking about whatever DMT or 5-MeO DMT in the 80s, people were doing it. It's just so much more because of the internet. Mostly it makes more sense that people have heard of everything now, but where were these people getting that information? Like in jazz clubs, like where did you get it?
That is, it's you would go to a hotel where Terrence McKenna would be on a tour of Holiday Inns.
And that's the best you could do.
Ramin had this great joke about
He's like, can you imagine just being in that hotel because you're at the hotel and you're like making a waffle and then you just overhear Terrence McKenna about the dribbling basketball.
That's hilarious.
Here's what my confusion is with the, like, I think that, so Ramin is the one that's in the moment. You're an in the moment type. I don't feel like I'm in the moment type of a person. I've done yoga. I've done meditation. I know what it's like to be in a flow state. I rock climb or did, and, you know, I do like pickleball and other things that like, I know what it feels like to be in the moment. I'm not sure that I like seek it out as much as like a lot of people are like, you gotta be in the moment. I don't know. I find myself like drifting off and dreaming quite a bit and doing those sorts of things. I sort of like that. Like I don't know. I like having like 5-year plans and 10-year plans and like putting together ideas for festivals and things in my mind.
Right. And the world is made of that type of logic, that type of skill.
Yeah, and I don't know that I'm told that I need to be more in the moment, but it just like it doesn't, I don't know, it just doesn't resonate with me.
Well, I have a couple thoughts. First of all, is like there's absolutely nothing wrong. I think that's a really beautiful perspective for what it's worth. That daydreaming, it's what I do. It's like when I'm thinking of a joke and I text it to myself in the car, I'm thinking of a future where I'm on stage doing stand-up. You know, you could argue that I'm not in the moment. There's a line in Be Here Now where it says like, well, what do you do when you make a plan? Like if you're making a plan for dinner on Tuesday, he's like, be there, be a person making a plan, be a person daydreaming about a festival, like do it fully. It's like a level of awareness, I suppose, that you're like, it doesn't have to be, I'm in the moment, so I'm just sitting at this table. You can be present while you're doing almost anything, I would say.
Yeah. I've done a lot of guided meditation and I have kind of gotten that message that like within every moment you can use those same skills and be more mindful and how useful it can be. I think it just oscillates. Sometimes I'm in the mood for it, other times I'm like, fuck all that. But I go back and forth a little bit.
Well, the other thought I had was, it's one of the things I love about you is that you're not trying to appear a certain way, right? And one of the cornerstones of my thought system or worldview or whatever you want to say is honesty, is this like brutal honesty. And what I'm hearing you say is like, I don't really enjoy being fully mindful. Like it's not the most exciting thing in the world to me. And you could really unpack it. We could spend the whole chat unpacking just that because you're looking at the ego will never think taking a psychedelic is a good idea because it's the disillusion of itself. It's the loss of control. And also being intensely present will never make sense to the Shane that is trying to insist that he exists and that time exists and that life matters and this is a table and there is air and we are on a planet. That's all real. So you get really present and all that stuff sort of vanishes. So that resistance is actually an interesting question. Like, what is it that doesn't want to be present? I would say, because what you described, it's the you that's yearning and churning and creating and desiring. And I'm saying there's nothing wrong with that, but we have to acknowledge that the ego or our mind or our personalities is never going to want to engage in an activity where it loses control and loses its sense of self. I admit to myself, I'll be reading something and you just go like, I don't believe this. I don't believe it. And I don't want it. And then that's actually like a really helpful step to actually unpacking it and applying it to yourself instead of being phony and being like, oh yeah, man, I want to vanish into the oneness. Yeah, no, you don't. Be honest. You're afraid of yourself.
And if you want to vanish into the oneness, like that's fucking great. If that is your genuine intent and everything, it's just like, I think you can't force it too much. I'm wondering if we could talk about free will for a bit. Do you want to hear that? This has been on my mind. This is going to be such a weird strange detour, but I heard about the craziest story that I've ever heard in my life from a friend of mine I talked to recently. And it's just had me thinking about free will. And now this is like coming up in this conversation. I think about it because, I think about like, well, I'm bipolar. I'm diagnosed as being bipolar. And that is categorized by having these episodes. But I don't just have episodes. I don't have episodes very rarely. Normally, I'm a normal person like that isn't having an episode. But I think about it and I hear the way that people describe me or like my behavior. And I'm like, you know what? I am an oscillator, like normally, like I do have pretty wild dreams and then I give up like and fall apart, like just wildly, thinking about how much is just my neurochemistry, whatever. We all have a thing like that, but how much can be improved upon or I should try to fix. So I heard this fucking story because, I've had like a couple like severe manic episodes and it just like it made me think, my God, what can the brain make someone do? And this is a eye surgeon friend of mine, one of my oldest friends. Do you keep up? You got a family now. How do you keep up with friends? Well, how old are you now?
I'm 43.
Do you keep up or are you drifting? Are you drifting away?
It's all changing. It changes. Now I'm friends with more people that have kids.
Yeah.
And then it's fewer, but like, there's been a changing of the guards. I'm still friends with the people I'm friends with, but like, there are some friends that I have that don't know I don't live in LA anymore. And they won't know for years because that'll be when they go like, hey, yeah. I'm walking by your house. Can I pop in? I'll be like, we don't live there anymore. And that's not very super close friendship. But now that we live in a small town and we have a daughter, it's like we're friends with people who our daughter's friends with. And I've been fortunate enough to find like spiritual people interested in the same things that I am. And I see those people every morning for coffee. We have coffee with these people every morning. So now I'm at 43, I'm actually learning what it means to have like regular contact with friends, not just comedian friends, comedians are friends the way pirates are friends.
Yeah.
It's like you're hoping to be storming the same castle in the same night. You know what I mean?
You're like, exactly.
You know what I mean? So
I have those friends and then I have like the old high school friends and some other people that, but it's, you get older and older. I was just talking, my editor is like mid 20s and I was just telling him, I'm like, just keep up. Like the older you get, the harder it is to like people get families, they get busy, they move on. And then there's just like a point where you just for no reason, don't think to just like text a friend to just like, oh, maybe I should text Pete and see what he's up to or whatever.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the times in my life when I had the most friends was when I was single or going through a breakup. And I hate how practical that is.
Yeah.
But it's honest. It's like when I was not dating anybody, your friends were the people that you would see every night. Instead of watching White Lotus with Val, I'd be texting Oren. I'd be texting Kumail, would be going out. That was the time of my life when I was like, there's a bar that's an arcade in Portland called Clarkade. We gotta go. And now I'm just like,
you got White Lotus and Val. That's a great thing to have.
I prefer White Lotus and Val, but I'm a highly sensitive person. It's why I'm a comedian. I go to Barcade. I really, this isn't to say I'm special or different. A lot of people are sensitive, but I feel like I'm shooting it on a higher resolution, meaning more sound is coming in, more visual is coming in, more danger is coming in, more confusion is coming in, and it's exhausting. Like finding one person I can share my life with, like the marriage model, like having like a steady, this is my everyday person works really, really well for me.
That's wonderful. So my friend just had my friend just had another newborn. So it's been, we haven't been in touch as much. And because of that, and he called and, it was a Saturday night and He's like having a cigar and some drinks and stuff. This is like his hanging out on the balcony at his place, like just winding down for the evening. And he's an eye surgeon, and he went way beyond medical school and just continued to get training and became like one of the best like plastic surgeon. Like, it turns out that just curing blindness and fixing people's eyes so they can see better is just like very easy to do. So it doesn't pay very well. And all of the money is just in fixing rich people's wrinkles. And you get into it because you go like, well, what they say is like, well, you can go and be outside like Disney World or Disneyland, and there's like kids getting their eyeballs knocked out all the time. And you get in there and fix one of these kids' eyeballs, and now like you've just changed that child's life. You stopped them from like getting made fun of in school and being disfigured and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. That's how they sell you. And then you get into it and you go, hey, you know, the money is pretty good from these like rich people that want to fix their wrinkles. And so he has all these like a new practice and stuff. He's doing very well with that. And so once he's in Chicago, once a week, he goes to Cook County. Are you familiar with Cook County? It's a famous county hospital in Chicago where just like all the most poor, all the like the worst, craziest cases go. And it's insane. Mm-hmm. And he's just like sharing this like kind of therapy session with me about just all of the stuff that he sees every single time that he goes in there on a Wednesday. And it's like insane stuff. It's like really dark stuff of like someone tries to blow their brains out and like they're still alive but their eyes shot out and they're deciding whether it's like worth putting their eyes back in because we don't know if they're gonna, like, that's just like a Wednesday for him. It's like the fucking craziest stuff that I've ever heard. And he's sharing these stories and we're just like laughing and like, but like concerned about just like the fucking madness of the world. Like there was he was in the cafeteria one day and there was a murder suicide by the cooks in the cafeteria. One of the cooks murdered another cook and then killed themselves. And they had to like keep the cafeteria open because it's a fucking hospital. All of these things. And I'm like, what the fuck is, he's like, you got to come on a rotation with me sometime. He goes, I guess the common thing that happens, he says 4 times a day, a Polish metal worker comes in who didn't wear their goggles. They like are a mechanic or something, and just a shard of metal shot into their eyeball. And you just like, it's very simple. You just get in there with a needle and pop that piece of metal out of their eyeball and put a couple drops in there. And he's going, that's just like, that happens so many times that like they don't even have him look at, that's like what residents and stuff work on. And he does this to like train residents and stuff. And then he tells me this fucking story
already. Shane, this is so fast. It's so fascinating how many different kinds of lives there are.
And like fucking crazy and troubling. Like no one's going to forget this story after they hear it. And it's so crazy that it's like it takes some of the tragedy out of it and the makes it like story. Kind of okay. humorous.
Okay.
So this guy, a guy comes in. This is just recent. He's just like, I'll just give you a recent one. A guy comes in. He was in jail. I'm going to text you a picture here in a second. It's not of an eyeball. I wouldn't do that to you. It's of an X-ray. A guy comes in and he had figured out a way to break out of his handcuffs. And I'll send this to McCool so he can put it in the episode. And he figured out a way to break out of his handcuffs. And when he did that, he took the broken part of the handcuff. Do you see this? Did you get the text?
Not yet.
And he ate the piece of the handcuff. He broke out of it. And then first move was, I'm going to eat this fucking piece of handcuff. Did you get it yet?
No, not yet.
Oh my God.
Oh, here it is. Oh no. He ate like the bottom hinge of the handcuff.
Can you imagine swallowing that?
Wow.
And Cook County, they're so busy and they are so desensitized that they have to like prioritize things. They only have so many.
Real quick, give me a second. Just making them my wallpaper, my dynamic wallpaper. Is this a live photo? I'm just kidding.
The gastrologist came in and they're like, oh, let them pass it. Let him pass, like instead of doing surgery to get it out, like, let's just see how that thing moves through the intestine. Oh, so God. At this point, you might be wondering, why did they bring an eye surgeon to look at a guy who swallowed handcuffs?
Yeah, I am wondering.
And what happened, and this is... This is where things get real crazy. He had found some piece of metal to break the handcuff off. And when he broke out of his handcuffs...
Oh, Shane, hold on. Hold on.
Yeah.
I can't believe I lost you.
You lost me? Oh,
sorry about that. Now you're through my headphones. I'm so sorry. Back up. Why would an eye surgeon be called in for a guy who is about to poop 30% of a handcuff?
It's because the piece of metal that he found to break open those handcuffs, when he broke open the handcuffs and swallowed the handcuff, then he took that piece of metal that he used and jabbed it into his own eye.
Why did he, am I wrong to look for logic here? Why did he swallow it? Do we know? No, just insanity. Just kind of.
Yeah, just having like a break, and then jabbed this fucking piece of metal into his eye, having a schizophrenic break.
Yeah.
And they bring my friend in, an eye surgeon, and he's like, well, is it in the eyeball? And they're like, no, it's in the like orbital lobe. Like it's in the casing. It's not in the eyeball. And they're like, he's like, well, is it impacting his vision? And they're like, no, he can see just fine. And he's like, okay, well, then this is like an elective surgery. And he's like, so does he want the surgery? They go, no, the guy doesn't want the surgery.
Oh my God.
He wants to keep it.
So what was the metal? What was the metal that's in his eye? Where did he get it?
We
don't know.
I don't know.
It's not in the ball, but it's going behind the eye and he wants to keep it like a piercing, like an ornament.
Yeah.
He wants it. Oh my God.
He wants. So then, I wonder if I can find these fucking notes that I made on this. So he wants to fucking keep it.
Why are they asking him? Why are they even at? Do you want to keep that? Yeah.
And so now it's like, well, how can you do the surgery? And he's like, it's an elective surgery. The only way I can do this against this guy's will is if a psychiatrist comes in and deems him insane. Yeah. So they can like put him out and take this out. Psychiatrist comes in, runs through the thing. The psychiatrist concludes, well, everything he's saying seems perfectly sane.
Whoa.
to me.
You know, this is weird, but as you're telling me this story, schizophrenia and what you know regular lay people just call insanity is one of the strangest things in the world, that your reality becomes something that other things sharing that reality deem invalid. And that has to be one of the scariest things in the world. So in the strangest way, this story is a little bit hopeful to me, because somebody listened to this person and was like, well, that's his reality. He doesn't seem... I don't know how they came to the conclusion that he's not a threat to himself, because isn't that one of the credentials?
Yeah.
Because he's clearly a threat to himself. He's been hurting himself. So it seems like maybe this person made the wrong call, you know?
Yeah. I think it's oh man, I'm trying to find what the... Because I talked with a therapist friend of mine, Cole, yesterday about it. And he's worked in psych wards and stuff. And he was laying down, there was like four criteria. First off, you need to be able to like demonstrate that you can hear what is happening and like understand what's happening. You need to be able to manipulate those ideas and like reflect them back. You need to be able to demonstrate that you can make a decision and that you can explain why you are making the decision. And then there's just like really strict criteria where it's just like our hands are tied at a certain point, because it's like people's liberty and freedom. And like you can't, if you do involuntary surgery to get a thing out of someone's eyeball and the surgery goes wrong and now they're blind from it and they could see just fine before that, and you did that against their will. Like there's all sorts of,
wow. This is already fascinating. And I'm so glad. I've often joked that I'm the person that wakes up from a coma. Let's say I wake up from a coma, or maybe not a coma, like I'm concussed and I come to, and they give me the like, are you okay test. I would fail that on my best day. If they were like, who's the Secretary of State or you know, sometimes I'm not entirely clear on who the president is. I'm going to be honest with you. Like there are just moments I'll be driving in my car and I'm like, it's Biden, right? You know what I mean? Like I'm not the most on top of it person. And if they were like, what year is it? What day is it? What month is it? I can, now I'm going back on what I said. I typically know who the president is. I never know what month it is. I never know. I live in California. It's sunny month. And it's either Christmas or it's the other ones. And I don't know what day of the week it is. I just don't. It's not how I live my life. So I would fail all those tests. So I'm glad that this test is basically just, they figured out a way to assess, is your brain's basic function work? Does it work?
Yeah. And like, do you have a plan and stuff? And so the guy's like, fuck yeah, I have a plan. I have a plan to keep this fucking thing in my eyeball because it's like badass and I'm going to jail or whatever. And they're like, they can't judge the decision. It's like, they aren't saying, no, that shit wasn't completely insane and crazy. They're just like working with what's in front of the, like people have a right to be crazy and like do weird things. And
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wonder, was that what it was? Like, he's like, this looks badass and I'm going to prison. That's not a bad guess.
That's my guess is like, how do you rationalize keeping it in there?
He's like, I think this is going to lead to a really good nickname on the inside. And you just want me to be old one blind eye. Like there's a lot of guys in prison with one blind eye. I want to be this guy.
I've lost power of attorney. Like I have been taken against my will.
Yeah.
To psych wards before for pretty crazy ideas. Sure. Right.
You weren't eating any handcuffs.
No, but I wasn't eating handcuffs. And so it's fucking amazing. But like, I also heard that, like I've been in states. I don't think I've ever shared this. I once at the peak of it was like weeks of a manic episode that were building. And at the very peak of it, hadn't slept in a long time, was in a dream state, could not understand what was going on, had all sorts of like, paranoia about fear. And I was like needing to confront my fears, which at the time were like jail or something like that. And so I ended up, this is the last time I was at a psych ward. I ended up naked, confronting police, telling them that, and I believed this with all of my heart. Like, I didn't think any of this was real and it was all a CGI reality. I was telling them that I was going to jump up their dick holes and make them explode. That was a thing that I thought, like, oh, I can just, like Ant-Man, I can just go.
Well, that's literally what Neo does. He jumps into Agent Smith's chest and explodes him.
Yeah.
So you were having a Matrix.
I was having a Matrix moment, but with dick holes because I'm a comedian.
Yeah. You, a funnier Neo has arrived. By the way, you know, that's a really interesting story. Did you know that The Matrix has had such an effect on like culture that's a real thing, that people have murdered people have done lots of different things because they watched The Matrix, they became obsessed, they became convinced that reality is an illusion and that if they do something like that, it'll snap them out of it. It's actually, I forget, there's a movie about, I don't recommend it because it's not for everybody. Like, for example, I just explained the movie to Val and she really didn't like it. She didn't like, meaning there are certain types of brains that are less afraid of being gaslit. Val's biggest fears is like, you're not being told the truth. You're being gaslit. For some reason, that's not my wound. That's not my trauma. Mm-hmm. So I can recreationally watch a movie where they're like, this is a simulation. And then they talk about Matrix theory and they interviewed a kid that was in jail because he murdered his step parents. And then he picked up the phone and said what Neo says at the end of the first Matrix, like into the phone. And like your guy at the hospital, in the legal system, apparently that's common enough. I'm not saying it happens all the time, but it's common enough that there's like laws, there's like document, you know what I mean? There's like, research to say this is called Matrix depersonalization syndrome or something. Isn't that wild? In yours, I wonder if you had not seen The Matrix, you know what I mean?
Like recently. Yeah. I mean, it does. If you ever have a manic episode, you will, at least in hindsight, curse yourself for ever watching any movie, because that's what it will, it's what your brain pulls from to make sense of things. It just starts what I'm experiencing right now is not compatible with the version of reality that I know. And so maybe like these movies and these fictions are actually more accurate. Maybe I'm in like a simulation and those movies were like the real thing trying to get through to me what's actually happening. And that's what's real. And that's how you, and it's the weirdest too, because what happens is you kind of, you just sort of, you notice more, and like most things just aren't worth noticing. And so your consciousness does a very good job of like putting blinders on to be like, you don't actually need to see these plants when you're walking down the street or whatever. You just need to like go forward. When you're driving, you don't need to see every single thing in the periphery. You just need to like be 10 and 2. And that gets shut down. And so everything has the exact same importance. And then because of that, all the things that you didn't consciously perceive before are novel, and you see them and you're like, oh, wow, how have I not seen that? That's been here this whole time. And then you attach to the novelty of that, and believe that you're having this like completely seeing the world in this way that everyone else is blind to, and then trying to make sense of like, but how me? How am I having this experience? What's special about me? And then the attached to like weird hero or enemy stories from movies and various plots and things that's like that. Really, and then you just fucking jab a thing in your eyeball.
Yeah. I mean, that's fascinating. There's a lot of thoughts on that. It's a lot of Ram Dass things about that. Actually, he says when you start getting deeper into meditation and deeper into your interior life, whether it be through meditation or yoga or whatever it might be, he says you'll rue the day you watched all those movies too, because it's all in there. He's like, it's all somewhere in there, and now you're going deep into meditation. His example is his Latin tense tables, like verb tense things. And he's like, oh, this fucking shit's in here still. And like, you're discovering all of that. But also what you're talking about,
that's fun.
There's another Ram Dass thing coming up where he says, like, you can't, like, Shane Moss can't sit at the right hand of God. And that's what he says is a lot of what psychosis is. You talk to, I sometimes would talk to the unhoused people in my neighborhood. A lot of them are having some sort of schizophrenic episode.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes they'd be saying, not always, almost always, it was something that I was like, oh, that was a disappointment because I'm selfish and I kind of want a magical kind of moment. Like, oh, I get it. I hear you. I believe, I love you. Like some sort of bond.
Yeah.
But oftentimes it was because you're having an epiphany or a revelation that it may be true. There might be something true to it. Mm-hmm. The world, in your case, is a miracle. Like plants on your walk are valid. We should stop and look at them. That's true. But the psychosis or whatever, I don't know if I'm using that term correctly, comes when you start going like, it's me, Shane Moss, who's been given this revelation. Shane Moss, the person. So he makes the joke that like, Joe Smith goes and sits at the right hand of God. You can't. This is what the dragons in front of Zen gardens are. They eat your ego before you go into the unitive consciousness because you're not invited. Otherwise, it'll break you. You have to like die. And that actually brings me to the last thing is all of these impulses that can be very dark. Suicide, certainly. The story I just told about the Matrix guy. That like realization that things aren't real, right? That they aren't what they seem, or that part of you needs to die is valid. Everybody would say at a certain age, you recognize there's part of me that isn't the real thing. It's a construct. And dropping it doesn't mean hurt yourself. Getting rid of it doesn't mean jump off a bridge. That is a perversion or an exaggeration of something that actually might be its origin might actually be in something that's real, which is like, this is bullshit, but don't destroy it. Keep going and find what's real. That's what I think the spiritual pursuit is. Do you see what I'm saying? Like spiritual realizations without a system to hold them and to frame them and a higher power and something bigger than yourself to bring into that conversation does lead to breaking human beings. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. Have you, in all of this, I know you've just gone so far in your spiritual practice and I know you're huge into Ram Dass. And everything. I mean, a lot of those insights had to have come from like real challenging states, you know, that Ram Dass experienced himself. Have you ever found yourself like troubled or having a difficult just kind of learning about this stuff, like reading about Ram Dass, hearing about his point of view, thinking about life in the exact way that you were just articulating? It sounds so, you know, together and logical and intelligent and hopeful and well articulated, but are there times along the way where you get like unsettled by some of it?
Yeah, for sure. I've just been getting into something called A Course in Miracles, which is a very fiercely non-dual thought system, for lack of a better term. And I noticed it's very gradual. It's like Vedanta. It's very similar to Eastern religions in some respects. It's very different from everything else I've studied in its own ways. But the idea is, instead of calling this Maya, it would call this a dream. It's like you're having a dream, which for me checks out. Rupert Spira has been a big teacher for me in teaching me that everything isn't just perceived with consciousness, it's actually made of consciousness. He's like, there's nothing to seeing, but you know what you see, and the knowing of what you see is what gives it its reality. So it's all made in consciousness. I can't explain it as well as he has. So I was sort of preconditioned to getting on board with the idea that this is a dream. And then it slowly, A Course in Miracles, the idea of it is to slowly wake you up. And it is the only one that I found that's like, this is going to be weird. It's like, it's very open about it. It's like, you're probably not going to like it. It might cause some anxiety, like someone telling you that you're not real and that your eyes aren't seeing anything. And it's all just kind of a make-believe thought experiment that you split from God, and you're having this weird dream that actually happened in an instant, but you're perceiving it over thousands of years. That can be really unsettling. That's since I've been doing that, there have been moments. I remember I was backstage at a show, and I just started getting paranoid. Like we're talking about, like, these ideas have to be dealt with very, very sensitively.
And
you know, adrenaline, I'm about to go on stage. Adrenaline can incite it. A fight flight response can incite it. So for me, it all needs to be lubricated with love and trust. I know that sounds sort of trite, but like, the reason I feel safe exploring the idea that what I perceive this reality is an ultimate reality is because I believe what is ultimate reality is loving and trusting and safe. So I'll balance something like, you know, the first lesson in A Course in Miracles is like, you take a pen and you go, this pen doesn't mean anything. You go, this pen doesn't mean anything. This glass doesn't mean anything. This hand doesn't mean anything. I'll do that lesson as long as I can balance it with another lesson from Course in Miracles, which is, love made me loving, patience made me patient, kindness made me kind. Like, it's a two-handed approach. It's like, sure, we can have our fun and go, this is an illusion, but you have to go like, but behind it is your true reality as a beloved child of God, like more precious, pearl of great price stuff. But I can't just do it. Like, I remember Doug Stanhope did my podcast, and I actually didn't release it because I didn't, no offense to Doug, but it was over Zoom and it just didn't click for me. And he talked about smoking DMT, and I was very interested in that. And he was like, yeah, we're just rats in a maze. It's all just nothing. It's all meaningless. And I was like, oh, isn't that interesting? If you do something like DMT or any of these weird, more extreme practices without that base coat of love, trust, surrender, held beloved child of godness, you might end up getting a message like that.
We've known each other for years. You were talking about all of this stuff before. I mean, you were with Val, but before you had children. How has having children changed this kind of approach and take toward, has it changed it at all? Does it change your approach to raising children? Does it change your approach to trying to articulate something to your
to
children?
The child?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an interesting question, because when you start dabbling in the unreality of yourself, right? I'm far more comfortable experimenting with the idea that I'm not real than I am with my daughter not being real. Like, that's the high.
Oh,
class,
that's interesting. You know?
Or even Val not being real like that.
That's interesting.
What's beautiful is that doesn't matter. I don't intend on telling Leela that, it's like a Ram Dass thing. You have to be somebody before you can be nobody. And I think you need to build a container before you can put something like this in there. So for me, And God hasn't come up with Leela. She's only four. But for me, it's really important to get the basics down, which is that you are loved, that there is something. And even in A Course in Miracles, which is so, like I was saying, it's very fiercely non-dual, it would say that your memory, your mind, contains the memory of oneness. And this is sort of like a tie to the divine. So even though this isn't real, there is some reality in it because there's a memory of oneness in our minds. So in that sense, that's the base code I'm talking about. And that's what I would teach Leela, is that, you know, we are God's love. God doesn't just love us. We're actually made of the only thing that actually is real. But yeah, you got to understand, like, even though I will dabble in this like really, really fierce non-dual stuff, I also still have Ram Dass, and I have Rupert, and I have Richard Rohr, and I have all these other things swirling around in my practice that ground me, that are a little bit more incarnational, meaning like God is involved and a part of this, and like it's not a mistake, and it's a classroom, and suffering is grace, and we're all just walking each other home. And that stuff is really important to me. But believe it or not, it's almost like good parenting has enabled me to cross the weird railroad tracks of spirituality and go like, or is it nothing? You know what I mean? Of that love and support makes me feel emboldened to look at some stranger ideas. Because in Vedanta and Course in Miracles, God doesn't know about this reality. That's like a very harsh thing. And that's what I was talking about before. Like, I don't even like that. That's not my preference. That doesn't serve my ego. It's not a nice story. But it's like, if God is perfect oneness, you can't have perfect oneness and then that perfect oneness is looking at the world. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's duality. That means that's where it gets the idea that everything that seems to be two and seems to be separate, and me and you and this and that and life and death and all these things, can't be ultimate reality. So it's this striving towards the only true reality, which would be oneness, or the Buddhists would call it the void, or the Hindus would call it Brahman. The Christians would call it heaven, or the Taoism would call it the Tao. But I don't plan on telling my daughter any of that. And there's a lot of times when I lean on other types of philosophies to give me comfort or love, or like I said, lubricate the whole system with more feeling, because it's pretty extreme.
Yeah, right. So how have you found ways to present some of these, just as we wrap up? Because I thought if I had someone listening right now who just has no idea who you are, I would tell them, I'm sure there's a few, but there's probably not many. I would tell them, check out your show, HBO Crashing. It was just 3 marvelous seasons. I thought it was the best representation of comedy and TV that I have seen. Stuff. There's been Louis, there's been Seinfeld, there's been great stuff, but it was actually like, wow, that was, you fucking nailed it. And one of the things that was so interesting, I always have things, you know, like I started with Josh Gondelman in Boston, and I remember being like, that's too bad that he is like so funny and so clever, and he's just like a little too nice for the comedy world. I think it's like not going to work or whatever for him. And it fucking worked. And I was so happy to see that. And in that same vein, you have been able to take ideas like this and bring them in. It's something I genuinely think quite a bit about, because I'm so into science and science communication and integrating like weird shit about neuroscience or whatever into my act is something that is more important to me than an audience oftentimes, unless I like bill a specific show, like this show's called Stand Up Science. This is what you're going to get. And I know you kind of do something similar where you have who's the pastor that you?
Rob Bell. Yeah. Rob and I did a tour together.
Yeah. So some stuff like that where there's context, but how have you found it? How, like, we both started out in comedy, like learning those basics, like rule of three, and here's how to make things funny and do this and that. How did you then take the things that were really meaningful to you and start finding ways to share through your comedy? Or do you even do that with stand-up? I know you do with the podcast.
I do. Well, that's the answer. You just gave me the answer. Thank you. I wasn't sure what I was going to say, but the podcast was what I always thought, you know, believe it or not, doing comedy, they were like, don't talk about religion. Certain people would say, don't talk about politics. That's actually come back a little bit more, the don't talk about politics thing, meaning some of the biggest people are the ones that, you know, kind of don't mention anything like that. So you can appeal to everybody. But I really came up believing that religion was something that you just weren't supposed to talk about. And especially because it was embarrassing. I remember being at Union Hall when I was probably 5-6 years into stand-up. And I tried to do a joke about how I love Jesus. I just don't love his fans. Which I don't, as I'm saying that now, like I say that with zero palpitation, no adrenaline, no anxiety. But when I said it, I felt like I had farted in the elevator. Like it just felt so weird. For those of you that don't know Union Hall, it's like this hipster Brooklyn bar.
Yeah.
And it just, I was trying to liken it to sports. Like you can like the fan, the sport, but not the fans. Yeah, and that's how I feel about Jesus. But I also hadn't figured it out. And doing the podcast, I started like a slow gas leak, just letting out a little bit of like, hey, I'm still curious about God stuff. Hey, I'm, and then a little bit of my story. And before I know it, I'm talking about my divorce constantly. I'm talking about losing my faith constantly. I'm talking about rebuilding my faith constantly and all these new things I was learning. And then before I knew that, the podcast just was a spirituality podcast. That's basically what it is at this point. Which is really cool. And then what happened was once I had found my fans, it was nice. Try the Devil was the first stand-up special where I did jokes about religion. And it was the name of the title. Nice Try the Devil was about not wanting to jerk off because I thought the second coming might happen. and I almost did. And then I went, nice try the devil. No way I'm going to have my ham and my sandwich when the King of Kings comes on a flying sheep through the golden clouds, you know? So
that's such a good special. I wish I would have rewatched some of your stuff. Cause you see me sending me you messages once in a while.
Yeah, like, no, I love it.
You
loved my hell bit, which I was really proud of because I think they're not to toot my own, but like, that hell joke, I think, is getting at something kind of interesting. And the reason I don't feel bad saying that was I didn't sit down trying to write an interesting joke. I just tried to say something honest about not being afraid of torture, but being afraid of the fact that we wouldn't get breaks to talk about the torture. And then that was on Dirty Clean. So after the podcast, I started realizing I could do this. And then I recently was like, oh, maybe I'll do an hour on Just God. And then I was like, okay, I'll save this 10-minute chunk from my new hour and I'll just put it in that. And I was like, that's just not how I work. I'd rather there just be 10 minutes about God in my new special than wait for some hypothetical hour I'm going to do about God. Who knows, man? I could be hit by a bus. Like, do it now. Just do it now.
Yeah.
So what I do is I say, do you guys want to hear my God jokes? And sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. Usually I'll do it either way, but like, it's if the show is going well, I'll say it. And then I'll say, I just want to warn you, they're not that funny. And that's true. They're not.
It's like you have the complete opposite version of the buckle your seatbelt.
Yeah. Unbuckle your seatbelt. You don't need to be buckled for these. But I really, I'm very proud of the jokes, but there's one that I've tried. I mean, I haven't worked harder on a joke in my life. And it's about how, either you think God created the Big Bang, something called God, incited the Big Bang or nothing incited the Big Bang. And I'm like, really, what's the difference? Like, I understand. Yeah. I saw you because you're too smart. I saw you roll your.
That wasn't an eye roll. That was a think.
It was a think. I didn't think it was a dismissive eye roll.
It wasn't dismissive.
I'm familiar.
I'm getting to what you're saying. I'm getting my brain to where you are.
Yes, yeah. That's right. It's a buy. I'm saying that a lot of not very scientific and not on the cutting edge of theory would say that the Big Bang erupted from nothing. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of lay people would say, in the same way that a lot of not that into theology lay people who are theistic would say that God, Big Banged. So it's looking at both explanations as being too cursory and saying, what's the difference? It's in both instance, it's something you can't see, touch, taste. You can't photograph it and science can't prove it. Both cases, you could say there's evidence of God, or there's evidence of nothing, but we can't prove nothing. And if you believe in nothing, that's fine. But at a certain point, isn't nothing just the name of your God? Because if it's erupting into everything, that's a pretty goddamn fucking magical nothing, right?
Yeah, it sure is. You are the perfect guest, Ramin, because this is our biggest dispute. Ramin doesn't believe in nothing. I'm like, but how can you? Math doesn't even work without zeros. What do you mean? Like, it just makes the things work.
Well, show us nothing. I mean, that's the same. That's the same sort of. What you're saying is there's evidence of nothing. There is a theoretical nothing, and there's also a theoretical God. Yeah. And when my definition of God is a mystery, not a certain old man in the sky, but a word that we use so we can talk more easily about a mystery that we don't understand. I don't care if you call your God nothing. I don't care if you call, because God is just a word that means origin. It just means origin. It means the beginning. It means the first thing. And if your origin is nothing, and I'm ruining the bit, but I don't care. And if you're an atheist and believe in nothing, when you die, where do you go? Into nothing. You mean back to your creator? I go, that's heaven, bitch. I'm like, that's the same belief. I'm not trying to shame anybody. I'm trying to say it's the same thing with different labels. We were born out of nothing. When we die, we go back into nothing. And by the way, why would you be afraid to go into God when you die? Why would you be afraid to go into nothing when you die if nothing has the potential to erupt into everything? Like, it's nothing except when it's everything. So when I die, I go into the building blocks of everything. That's hope. There's hope to that. Tell me your response. I love that.
I love that. That doesn't work at all.
It works. It's just not funny. Are either of us laughing? It's just kind of like you go like, that's good. I won't stop doing it. Here's the punchline. Then I go, I know this just turned into a TEDx talk. And then I go, let's pray. Heavenly Father. Let's all, you know, like that's how I make it funny. But you and I are playing a similar game. I'm interested in like, when do I have permission to say something that is maybe the most important thing I have to say? If you give me the right to not be funny for 10 minutes, I'll say the only thing that you'll remember from the special. And honestly, I learned that from Dirty Clean. Dirty Clean has that joke where I go, nothing makes any fucking sense. Everything is atoms. These atoms know they're atoms, and some of the atoms in the table become me, and some that were me become the table. And Bill Nye, the science guy, did my podcast. He taught me this. Why doesn't my hand go through the table? Why do they repel each other? The answer is we don't know. That doesn't make any fucking sense. So that became far and away the most popular bit I've ever done. And I'm telling you the truth. When I would tour that hour, I wouldn't do it because it didn't work. I saved it. That's I have certain bits where I'm like, you do this bit for the taping, not exactly. In Cleveland.
Because a fucking comedy club audience in a TV taping, those are two different audience. And what works when someone is by themselves in a car listening to something, and what works when someone is surrounded by social pressures to conform and laugh at the appropriate time in an appropriate way are two very, I learned that lesson a great way and a very hard way, which is I took a very big chance on my first album with something that never worked in a club and it worked really well. And then my first special, I did all stuff that worked in a club, and it didn't work well on the taping as well.
Yeah. That's it. I've never heard anybody except you and me talk about this. There's bits you only do for the special.
Only do for the special, man. Yeah. And if you can get a couple, because especially if you can get that first taping to go well, then that second one is when you can throw in all that stuff. I'm putting together this whole immersive psychedelic comedy show for Vegas and everything, and I'm deciding, like, I have all the funding and stuff lined up to make it a special and to do everything. I'm trying to decide what I'm going to do with it exactly. Mm. But it's nice to talk to you about.
You should about, be the
it's
first an, special.
It's nice reminder.
You should be the first special that has a deal with dimethyltryptamine, where if you smoke it at 8 o'clock on a certain night, the night of the premiere, it will be beamed directly into your pineal gland. That would be brilliant. I don't think it would work, but there is a TV show idea where it's the DMT universe. And it's
shows I've made for the DMT experience.
Yeah.
That is,
isn't that fun?
So I smoke DMT. I get together with the gang in there. The whole crew.
Only on DMT. Shane Moss's new special, only on DMT, with an after show on 5MEO. Tune in. That's the way.
That would be a fun. There's a fun bit here of like a. Have you ever seen the part during DMT where you jump down the tunnel into everything, but you pop right back out?
You told me
at
about
that
this.
Same the tunnel, and room. Then you do it again, and it's over and over again. I wrote that.
Yeah. You know, the one where time is a place and you can revisit the best parts of your life. And if you want, you can just stay there. But the weird thing is most people go to the bad parts over and over. I wrote that.
Yeah, it was a shower thought.
Yeah. Total shower. Steven Spielberg, he said it in a tape recorder. That is so funny.
Oh, all right, my friend. Thank you so much for joining me. I think I really like that bit. First of all, one fun thing is it wasn't a big bang at all. Like the term the big bang was
something
that.
I thought we measured the radiation.
Someone said no. It like wasn't big. It started very, very small, and then it was a grower, not a shower. It was just like a little. It was like a little blip, and a big bang was like meant as a slight. It was like on a radio show. Someone was like, they believed in the static universe, and they're like, I don't believe in this big bang theory. And then physicists just owned it. They just owned it. They're like, yeah, big bang. It's big. Cause doesn't it sound like the dumbest name ever? Yeah. It's like a child came up with it. It's like, it was a curious fizzle that probably happens all the time through space time that just like took off and started for a while. It was like, the universe was the size of an orange for a very long time. Like it expanded to the size of an orange and then stayed like that for the whole universe. Wow. The size of the orange for a while. And then it expanded.
That's wild. Yeah, that was part of my joke too. I was like, big? Big is relative. Like, how could anything be big?
What?
Yeah, compared
like, substantial
to what?
Also, burst, like,
bang, there's nothing there to hear it. Like, bang is a sound. It requires a second party to go, wow, that was loud. But that there's also the theory.
And like which, size and time, like the size of an orange seems small to us. But when the universe was the size of an orange, it was just the size of a universe. It was just a universe sized universe.
It could still be the size of an orange. Right.
Yeah.
But there's a theory that is more in line with my thinking, which is that there's universes being birthed inside of other universes, but there was no nothing into which one universe, that's a little bit self-centric or Milky Way centric to be like, there was nothing. And then us, why wasn't there something like this? And then another one, and then another one, and another one. That seems more fractally in line. Like it's always been happening.
What if, cause this might seem like a slight to the idea, but like, I wonder if with your delivery, because I fucking love you reminded me of some of your own material earlier on when you're talking about the '80s and being in the moment, some of your older stuff about the, needing to go to the library to know something and like loving magic and like I think the tone and the message of those jokes has always just like resonated with me so much. And there's something about like, well, where did the Big Bang come? There's something like, don't we all deserve to get to have a bit of like mystery and wonder and that's a nice place to hold my, like, scientists, stay the fuck out of like my mystery. You aren't going to find out anyway.
Right.
like, let me have that fucking thing at least. Yeah.
But I'm not worried about it. When I remember Tim Minchin did my podcast and I said the unknown and he went, the not yet known. Like he was very convinced that we would know everything. And I, at some point, and I was just sort of like,
no way.
I don't understand. Look, I'm not anti-science at all. Science is how we're talking to each other. Science is, you know, keeping my body healthy, all these things. But it is, if this is a dream, it's funny that there are things in the dream studying the dream to the point where they're like, we get this. And almost any neuroscientist worth their salt will tell you that we don't understand 99% of the brain.
Oh, yeah.
We don't understand 99% of the physical universe. And all these theories are theories. Big Bang is a theory. The orange is a theory. No, like no one can say, they can say we have this idea and we're testing it. And it's always going to be changing and shifting. But maybe I just lack the scientific imagination, but a model for like consciousness, like to reproduce it and understand what knowing is, the quality of your being that is knowing the information that's being fed into it by its senses. I'm just sort of like, it's always going to be it studying itself. And how can it studying itself ever be like completely outside of itself enough to know it?
Yeah, it's just, this just means now I got to have you back on to have a whole conversation about consciousness. You really did it to yourself on that one. No.
Well, I will. I'll do my best to summarize Rupert Spira. Spira. He's the best. Check him out. He has a book on his website called Being Aware of Being Aware, and it is a life changer. And it's very easy to read. Very, very simple.
And where do you want to direct people to? We haven't caught up in a minute. Do you have a new exciting thing that you're plugging or in the works, or just the same awesome stuff that exists and can be enjoyed at any time?
That's right. Go follow me on Instagram or TikTok because that's where I put my clips. But those clips are also to remind you that I'm touring, and all the tour dates are on PeteHolmes.com. And you can hear me do that bit. It's a little bit different live. And you can go, I was there when Shane helped him with that joke.
Do my listeners sound like me too?
I was there. I jumped in his dick hole. Can you imagine? You're naked going, I'm going to jump in your dick hole because this is a CGI.
And that's just what the cops got that day. They weren't mad about it. They were like, this is very amusing to us. Yeah. They're like, we got to take care of you. We're definitely strapping you to a fucking gurney.
Yeah, a gurney. Like,
throwing you in an ambulance.
I would have been like, if this is a CGI simulation, why my dick hole? Just jump into the nothingness that I am. How about belly button? How about nostril? Dick hole seems like a you thing. That's a weird choice.
they didn't negotiate at all.
They should have. I won't give you dick hole. My urethra It's not your urethra. It's my urethra.
Thank you so much, my friend. And here's a little sign off that we do. It's Pavlovian, a little sciencey sign off, which is until next time, keep on salivating, honeys.